Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, August 12, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the new book, The Conservative Heart, How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we are pleased to welcome the author of the book, The Conservative Heart, Dr. Arthur C. Brooks, who is also president of the American Enterprise Institute. A more complete bio of Dr. Brooks was provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there. Reserve more time for Dr. Brooks' presentation on his book, and then after that, your questions. So with that, Dr. Brooks, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian, and thanks to all of you who are on the call today. It's an honor for me to be with you. I've been a many-year admirer of the work of the Federalist Society, and all of that is on the basis of the strength that comes from its members. So to be able to add a little bit to the thinking of this great organization is an honor and a privilege for me. I'm president of the American Enterprise Institute, as you've heard before. I've been the president for about 7 years. AEI is right at the middle of political debates here in Washington, D.C., and is a voice in the conservative intellectual movement. It has been going back all the way to 1938. As such, one of the things that we like to do, or we sort of have to do, is to look at the trends in the conservative intellectual movement and how they impact politics in America today, how the conservative political movement is taking ideas and what its biggest liabilities and dangers are. People running for president and leaders in Congress ask me what's the biggest problem in terms of the image of conservative politics today, it's a pretty easy question to answer. The biggest reason that Republicans don't win more than they do and that conservatives don't get more respect in the popular conversation and the media than they do is the perception, which is a pretty widely held perception, that conservatives don't care about ordinary people. And if you don't believe it, let me give you a couple of statistics. In 2014, when Gallup asked Americans, do you believe the word compassionate describes the Republican Party? The answer was no, 11 to 1. 11 to 1. So if you look just at the people who are saying yes, and you rule out blood relatives of Republican Party operatives, it pretty much rounds to zero. Republicans are considered, or the Republican Party at least, is considered to be uncompassionate. This is, without a doubt, what was Mitt Romney's downfall in 2012. There are typically three questions that exit pollers ask: who had the better ideas, who represents better leadership, and who cares more about people like you? Romney won handily on the quality of ideas. He won on the quality of leadership. He lost 80-20. Who cares more about people like you? The truth is that people don't believe that you have a sense of compassion, particularly in a country that's being left behind by policies that are marginalizing people in the bottom half and policies that are resulting in approximately 0% economic growth rate. If you don't have a solution and it appears that you don't care, you won't win at the national level. And that's my topic today. Now, first of all, when I talk to conservatives about this, I'm not just trying to be grim. I say, let's look at the facts. I mean, the good news is that this can be changed. But it starts with an understanding of what the conservative movement really is all about and how this has affected those who have been left behind, the vulnerable, the poor, for example. And let me just go through a couple of quick facts for you. And if you're a conservative like I am, I'm hoping that this is pretty heartening stuff. It should be. From 1970 until today, if you look at world poverty around the world, you'll find that there are some pretty stunning dynamics. Some things have changed that are really worth paying attention to. Most Americans, by the way, believe that since 1970, hunger around the world has increased. They're wrong. Those of you who pay a lot of attention to this know that the percentage of the world's population living at starvation levels around the world since 1970 has decreased by 80%, an 80% decline in the world's worst poverty. Now, you have to ask yourself why. As an economist, this is what I set myself to. The reason I became an economist, and ultimately the reason I became a political conservative, which is not where I started out, was because poverty is what I care about the most. And here's what I learned. The answer for why an 80% decline in the world's worst poverty is not because of the success of the United Nations or USAID or any of those transnational organizations or central planning or global socialism or anything like that. It is simply put six powers, six truths: globalization, free trade, property rights, the rule of law, and entrepreneurship. It was the American free enterprise system that started spreading around the world after the explosion of mass communications in 1970 that has pulled 2 billion people out of poverty. And there's a sixth force as well. And the sixth force is that for many parts of the world that rely on free trade, such as China, where 680 million people have been pulled out of poverty since 1980 alone, free trade has only occurred because of peaceful sea lanes for the first time in human history, guaranteed by the American military. So think about it. Globalization, free trade, property rights, the rule of law, American free enterprise through entrepreneurship, and American military power. This, my friends, is the conservative agenda. If it were not for the spread of those good things around the world, 2 billion people would not have been pulled out of poverty. These values are our gift truly to the poorest people in the world. Now, it's not just the economic agenda. It's not just economic policy. We also know in the world of social sciences what leads to the most success in life. I've studied the subject of happiness and human success for many years. I've written books on the subject, and you don't really have to do as much reading as I've done to figure out how what the greatest secrets to success in the United States, at least, are, which are also the pillars of happiness. There's basically a happiness portfolio, which is what we would recommend to our children, but also to people who need these secrets to get ahead in life, to do well in life. And they're very simple. The four pillars of success, economic success, as well as social success and happiness, are faith, family, community, and earn success through meaningful work. So faith, family, community, and work. Add that to the economic agenda I added before, plus American national security, and you have a full-on conservative agenda. These are the secrets to giving people around the world a better life and giving people in America a more meaningful life. And these are the things that are most missing from the most desperate people in our country and around the world today. People need our secrets. Will liberals give them to them? Never. The truth of the matter is we need to be warriors for the poor. The answer to what ails conservatives politically is the same thing that's written on our hearts and what the world needs. Here's the best news of the day. If we simply say the truth, which is what our hearts dictate that we really want for everybody, this is the secret to political victory as well. It's as much of a win-win as I've ever seen in my many years in the public policy profession. So how do you do it? How do you do it? What's my advice for conservative politicians and policymakers? The first is to remember that our values are good for people and we need to share them. Now, how do you share your values? And I know this sounds kind of obvious to a lot of people on this call, but it's not nearly so obvious to people who are in the pugilistic world of presidential politics today. Here's a way not to share values. Hit people over the head with them and tell them they're dummies and idiots for not sharing them. It turns out, I know this is going to come as real news, that nobody's ever been insulted into agreeing with us. Yet this is kind of the environment in which we find ourselves. Somebody who doesn't agree with us is a moron. Somebody who doesn't agree with us is somebody who is bereft of basic common morality and decency. That's a mistake. If we have something that's good and true and right and that people need, we need to share these things in a mood of brotherhood. We need to share our values in a way that's not nasty. We have a gift for America and for the world, and we need to share it in that spirit. The second piece of it, in other words, be nice. And more on that later. The second piece of advice that I ordinarily give to Republican politicians, particularly in this climate, is never to play the victim. It's very easy when we're listening to Obama, and you heard Obama at American University the other day, in written remarks, say that the radicals that were chanting death to America in the streets of Tehran were making common cause with conservative Republicans right here in Washington. It was absolutely shocking. It was as bad as it gets. President Obama is someone who, and this is the great disappointment, political disappointment of my adult life, is someone who campaigned on unity and optimism and has governed on the basis of pessimism and division, ad hominem, vilification, enemies lists. It's a worst missed opportunity that I've seen in many, many years. You listen to this, and it's easy to feel victimized when you're on the conservative side, or when you read the press, or when you listen to academics, or when you pay attention to Hollywood, and I could go on. Why is this a mistake? Why is it a mistake to feel like the deck is stacked against us and talk this way? And the answer is because of an emerging body of research that shows that when people act like victims, they are seen as lacking in moral character. They are seen also as being fundamentally uncompassionate. The more that we act as if we're getting a bad deal, the more people are going to see us as uncompassionate people, which feeds into the very stereotype that we have to militate against if we want to turn the current political scenario around. There's one of my favorite studies on this, by the way, that reinforces this. Four Stanford psychologists in 2010 ran a human subject experiment on 104 undergraduates, and they asked these undergraduate students to write either about something that was innocuous and boring in their lives, or the last time that they had been treated unfairly and they felt like a victim. It was a treatment and control. It was a well-done experiment, so there was random samples. And afterward, there were personality assessments on the human subjects. And what they found was that those who wrote about unfairness turned out to be, they didn't get to choose. This was affecting their character. Those who had just written about unfairness and victimization were those who were much more likely to exhibit selfishness afterward and to report feelings of entitlement. And the funniest part of the study, by the way, is in a footnote to the study where the researchers complained that the people who had said that they were victims left their trash on the table and stole the experimenter's pens. So there you are. Don't be that guy is basically the advice. We're not victims, and we shouldn't act like victims. Advice, the third piece of advice I give is and this is the most important one of all, is to go where we're not invited. I just got back from the much-famed Red State Conference in Atlanta. It made a lot of news because Donald Trump was disinvited from this Red State Conference, and everybody was talking about that. But I do a lot of these things. I do a lot of conservative events. I give about 150 speeches a year, and a non-trivial number are for people in the conservative movement. And one of the things that I try to get across is that while talking to true believers is all well and good, true believers vote and they knock doors and they give time and money, you have to get out of your community. We have to go where we're not invited. We have to go outside of our comfort group so that we can talk about our ideas for saving the country and people can see really what is on our hearts. And that means going to two groups where conservatives have traditionally been uncomfortable. Now, I know you're thinking I'm going to say a particular set of demographics, you know, say African Americans and Latinos or single women or the Upper West Side of Manhattan or something like that, but that's not what I'm going to say. The two groups where we are uncomfortable are what I'm going to call persuadables and hostiles. Persuadables are people who are, they're not with us, but they could be if we were attractive enough. Hostiles are people who think that we're evil and stupid. That's your left-wing sister-in-law. Those are people who are outraged about poverty under Bush, but seem not to notice that there's an even bigger problem under Obama. We need to go to these two groups. Now, how do we do it? How do we do it? Where do we find them? Persuadables are disproportionately on college campuses. We think this is hostile territory, but it's really not. When I taught at Syracuse on the public policy faculty, Syracuse at the Maxwell School is the most left-wing policy school in America, based on how the professors rank in terms of their party affiliation. 97% Democrat are for the left, and when I left, it went up to about 99%. I think it was, it's that bad. So why is this not a completely hostile territory? The answer is because students are persuadable. Nobody knows this better than the Federalist Society. The astronomical success, the incredible success of this organization, has to do with this observation that people are not automatons. They will think for themselves, and this the point. We have to find more opportunities to get onto more campuses in front of more people who are impressionable and fundamentally sensible, just looking for an opportunity to look to think in a different way. This is what we do at AEI. We're on 420 college campuses now. It's the biggest college campus network in the whole think tank world because they are, in fact, persuadable. And what's the message? Think for yourself. Why are you in college? To be a sheep? To take the ideas as given from your professors, or actually to think through new ideas? It's an astonishingly easy sell to get people to listen to new ideas, particularly when they're couched around doing good for the least among us in our society, for the most vulnerable members. Hostels are trickier. Where are the hostels? The hostels are the faculty. The hostels are the places that we go that traditionally don't like conservatives, the NAACP meetings, the teachers union, these types of places that the editorial page of the New York Times, for example. This is hostile territory. How do we deal in those situations to get our message out? And the answer is answering anger with civility and even with love. And why would we bother with hostiles? They're unlikely to convert and become conservatives like us. And the answer is basically because persuadables are watching how we deal with hostiles. When we talk to hostile people, do we get angry? Do we insult? Do we act like Obama? Or even worse, do we shut down the government? Is that what we do? Because if we do that, then persuadables watch, and they're convinced that the hostiles and their attitude toward us was right all along. On the other hand, we have an opportunity to negate these opinions, to make people think for themselves in new ways just by virtue of our example. Now, here's the key point in getting out of our comfort zone, going and talking to new people. Looking at the data, it's very clear. Millions of Americans are looking for an excuse to follow a more conservative ideology, and we're not giving them that excuse. I have talked to any number of people, and I've seen in our data sets over and over again that, for all intents and purposes, here's what's going on. There are people who know that the left has made a hash of public policy and is making a mess of our country and is not paying attention to the Constitution, all the things that are driving us crazy on this call today. But when they go home and they talk to their wives and they talk to their friends, they say, oh, these conservatives, they hate gays, they hate women, they're racist. Are we giving them ample ammunition to say, actually, I talked to this conservative lawyer today, and he was fighting for the poor every bit as much as President Obama and anybody on the left. And you know what? Given the fact that race relations don't appear to be better and poor people don't appear to be better off, maybe we should try something new. People are looking for an excuse to be able to see these, say these things. We need to provide them with this excuse. Our ideas are right. This is my last comment. Our ideas are right. They help the most people live the best life, and that means a life not of welfare and dependence, but of opportunity and dignity and freedom and meaning. And a lot of people are being denied these things today. Winning politically and ideologically means sharing our blessings with people who need it the most. So the last question I ask myself, and I'll offer up to you respectfully, is this. The question is not if I'm angry enough to fight for my values. The question is whether or not I have enough love to fight for what's right for people who need it the most. If I do, and we do, 2016 is going to be a very good year for conservative politicians, but more importantly, the next decade could be really a new beginning in American public policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Brooks, for that excellent presentation. Well, let's go ahead and go to our audience. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And for those of you interested in buying the book, and the email that you receive should have a link to The Conservative Heart. It is, of course, available on Amazon.com. And Dr. Brooks' last book, The Road to Freedom, was a New York Times bestseller, and it sounds like this one is probably on its way to being another. So we've got two questions that jumped on, and we will go right to them. Hi, caller, are you there? They may have forgotten to unmute them. We'll go to our
Hello?
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is Manny Klausner from Los Angeles. I'm with the Reason Foundation and with the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I have a question. I really appreciate Dr. Brooks's comments, his long campaign for civility and compassion, as he puts it, and I think it's very, very effective. I'm curious, Dr. Brooks, how would you approach discussing the issue of religious liberty in the wake of the tremendous hostility to those who don't want to do business with others, being bakers or other will perform wedding ceremonies in a gay marriage? How would you approach the issue in speaking to gays who think that people who are religious are bigots and hostile to gays?
To begin with, Manny, thank you very much for your kind comments and for your excellent question, by the way. To begin with, it's very important that we have clear in our hearts that we're not bigoted. And again, that's always the beginning of any sort of reformation, is making sure that the criticisms that are coming from the other side are not true. And so do we really want an inclusive movement? That's not always clear, by the way. And when, you know, the left has talked about wanting to be inclusive for many years, yet they don't want to be inclusive. It's very clear that they don't want people who think differently. College campuses don't want people who think differently on their faculties. So that's the first question to ask. Are we bigoted? Do we have the sentiments that we say we do on this? After that, the right way to approach this, and it doesn't matter. I mean, conservatives are on both sides of this. Libertarians are on one side, and social conservatives frequently are on the other side of this. But it's always the same basic criteria. If we want to connect with people and they understand that we're fighting for them, we need to stop fighting against some policy. We need to stop fighting against simply an idea, and particularly an idea that's put forth by the other side, and start fighting for people who are vulnerable. If we have a virtuous competition of ideas on behalf of the most vulnerable people, then the idea competition doesn't become a holy war, which is effectively where we are today. You know, we have a holy war between right and left on many battles, and religious freedom is one of these things. So what I'm suggesting here is, regardless of where you come down on this particular issue, look at the people who are most adversely affected. Find their faces and advocate for those people. Tell their stories. If you're fighting for people as opposed to fighting against things, you're on the way to winning, and winning for what you want to win for, as opposed to simply winning a particular skirmish in the holy war of non-ideas.
All right. Well, we have one more question pending, and our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask Dr. Brooks a question about his book, The Conservative Heart, press star and then the pound key.
Yes, Dr. Brooks, thank you so much for your presentation today. I really appreciate it. Along the same lines, how would you recommend that conservatives talk about the recent race relations and police shooting issues? Because it doesn't seem to fall along the typical economic or social issue line that we see a lot of conservative thinkers talk about. So thank you again.
Thanks, I appreciate it, and I've given this one a lot of thought too, as you can imagine. When conservatives look at Ferguson, Missouri, or Baltimore, or any of the places that are exploding right now in the worsening race relations, we can look at some manifest truths. Things have gotten worse in race relations under President Obama. We can talk about that if we want, but that's pretty unproductive. We can go into the details in Ferguson, Missouri about, you know, the kid who got shot. He'd actually just robbed a store, and go into, but that's pretty unproductive too. The big story from a conservative perspective is that these communities are in turmoil because of a manifest lack of opportunity, and that's a human tragedy. When you look at the indignity in which these people are living, or you look at the fact that right now we have 33.2% unemployment among young African American men, you see that that's the real scandal. It's a lack of opportunity for lots of reasons, for cultural reasons and for economic reasons and for policy reasons and structural reasons. I've got that. But if we can actually put our heads together to talk about the opportunity crisis, then a lot of the things that are being couched and used by the grievance industry as racial issues would largely go away. So how do we deal with these things? We advocate on behalf of the people who are suffering the most. And always, always in these situations, the person who's suffering the most is the one who doesn't have opportunity. Now, they could very productively express that in terms of throwing rocks or robbing stores. I have that. But let's remember who the people who are being hurt the most are right now by the lack of opportunity in this country, and make ourselves out to be the warriors for that opportunity for the long-term structural redress of these particular issues, and then people will see us differently.
All right. We are talking with Dr. Arthur Brooks, the president of the American Enterprise Institute, about the conservative heart. We have three more questions on the line, so we'll go right to those.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. This is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity. As you know, I'm a great, great fan of yours.
Likewise, Roger. I've been reading your stuff since I was back in academia. I've always been a huge fan.
Well, thank you very much. And terrific presentation today, and I've got your book right here. I wanted to ask one sort of follow-up question to Josh's, and then ask one that's an additional question that's sort of along the same lines. As you know, one of the things that you pointed to as being a great conservative truth is the importance of family, and I think that in the poverty context, what that translates into, to be blunt, is don't have children out of wedlock. And as you know, I've written many times over the years that this is really the principal cause of so much of the racial disparities that we see, whether it's in terms of poverty or crime or you name the social malady. So my first question is, how do you talk about that in a way that is productive and not divisive? And then my other question is, it's not race relations, but it's, I guess, maybe ethnic relations. How should conservatives be talking about immigration and assimilation issues?
Thank you, Roger. Excellent questions. How do we talk about something like effectively family values, out of wedlock births, trying to increase marriage? The way that we talk about that is as the gift of our secret to success. We should have zero embarrassment about the fact that faith and family and community and work not as a paycheck, but work as a source of dignity and an organizing principle in a sanctified life, that these four things truly are the secrets of success, and we want to share these things in a spirit of real brotherhood. When you present these things as a gift, some people will reject them, some people will mock them, but let them reject and let them mock. When we use them as a weapon, they'll be roundly rejected as a hostile, effectively an assault on the character of lower-class African-Americans, for example. When we share these things as a gift, particularly when they complement the economic policies of equal opportunity and increasing opportunity, preference opportunity for these particular communities, when we're trying to invest more in places that will lift people up, then it becomes part of a sort of a holistic approach that's both social and economic to these types of communities. I write about this a lot. There's a chapter in my book called The Conservative Social Justice Agenda, and I use that under advisement. One of the things that I recommend in the debate training manual portion of the book is to steal the language and icons of the other side. I talk about social justice all the time because I want to define social justice in a conservative way that truly does bring justice into society in new in creative ways. The poverty and injustice that we have in the United States today is a heartbreak for all of us, and trying to create a cure for these things is a matter of social justice. So again, an integrated agenda of social and economic policies, where the social policies are the gift of our values that we know that in point of fact brings more success and meaning to people's lives, is something that we should be able to share in a way that we're not embarrassed about, because we're not doing it in a spirit of hostility. Now, how do you deal with immigration? The immigration situation that we have in the United States, again, conservatives come on, there's a schism in the conservative movement, and that schism is a source of delight and pleasure for the left. The left is dining out on the disagreements on the conservative side. I mean, that basically Harry Reid is saying every day to the Republicans, you guys have to get your story straight. Are you more racist or are you more greedy? You guys decide. Which is, and then everybody's kind of blinking at each other. Nobody knows exactly how to react to this terrible dilemma. And part of the reason for this is that we haven't been able to do the things in immigration policy that we all know are a pretty good idea, and doing those things first to try to get to more of a consensus. Now, somebody who's an enemy of immigration reform will suggest the so-called grand bargain. The grand bargain is the enemy of progress because they don't happen very well. They don't happen in politics very much, and they almost never happen in business. You know, in business, if you want to do something, you do it incrementally. You put together a strategic plan. You want to know where you're going to be in 5 years and the steps to actually get there. This has never been truer than in the case of immigration policy in America. It's about 30 steps over 5 years, and some of them are politically much easier and saleable and important than others as well. So we should prioritize those things and start walking through them until we get to the real roadblocks. And at that point, we should have a better sense of consensus and certainly more consensus on the right. Number one is H-1B visa reform. It's high-skilled immigration. It's not a mainstream position at all to say that we should be cutting off high-skilled immigration to this country, where between 2 and 3 jobs are created by every high-skilled immigrant among native-born Americans. I mean, it's absurd that we can't sort this thing out. It's being poisoned by the Obama administration again and again and again because they want to make it out like it's part of a grand bargain. Stupid. Second is something like a guest worker program. Third, we need an E-Verify system. Fourth, and you can march through the list like that and make real progress before you hit the real roadblocks. And by doing that, it looks pretty clear that Republicans and conservatives are going to be able to make progress, and they're not patently hostile and intransigent toward all immigration.
All right. Well, we have over 100 people on the call and still have 2 more questions and plenty of time. So if you'd like to ask a question of Dr. Arthur Brooks from the American Enterprise Institute about the conservative heart, press star and then the pound key. All right. 2 more questions pending.
Dr. Brooks, I've enjoyed your book so far. Admittedly, I'm only halfway through it, but I'm curious to know, have you reached out and been successful in reaching out to the presidential campaigns? And if so, to what extent have you seen the fruits of your labor, at least? Because I think you have a great message to share, and I think it's not out there completely yet in the common dialogue. I'm curious to know your thoughts and what you've done so far.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. In the last 7 years since I've been president of AEI, we've worked very, very hard to drill into the foundation of leadership on the Republican side, on the Democratic side, to the extent that we can. Now, no, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not on Hillary Clinton's speed dial. That's a much harder sell, to be sure. But the result of the work of the past 7 years is that we know everybody who's running for president on the Republican side right now, and we have a good relationship with all of their campaigns already. So the answer is yes, they all have this book. 4 of them have gotten in touch, having actually finished reading the book. And I've had deep discussions with, I guess, 7 or 8 of them already about the content in this book. Now, it is a different way of thinking than what they've been trained to do and what they've thought about doing. It's not the traditional conservative playbook. If it were the traditional conservative playbook, I think that we would be seeing different outcomes in politics today. And I'm not the first one to have thought that. A lot of people, much more prominent and better than me, like Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan and great men, have said that before as well, who were true optimists and who brought joy and compassion and a sense of fairness to everything that they did in politics. But it takes retraining. It takes practice. And so in the ongoing conversations that we have with some of them, that I personally have with some of them, I talked to them. After they finished the debate, I talked to some, reached out, some of their campaigns reached out, and little by little by little, we're hoping that we can make some incremental changes. Now, another full disclosure, I have never talked to Donald Trump except in passing, and he's not reached out, suffice it to say. The whole optimistic notion of unity and joy and what we can do for the country seems to have eluded that part of the political discourse. But as they say, hope springs eternal. So we're working hard. We're working hard to embed this as much as we possibly can in all the candidates. And I'm hoping that you will see progress in the coming months.
All right. Well, we have one more pending question, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to pick the brain of Dr. Arthur Brooks from the American Enterprise Institute about his new book, The Conservative Heart, press star and then the pound key.
Dr. Brooks, John Montague, Tampa, Florida. It's a pleasure to listen to you today and follow many of your readings. I'm just curious on your thoughts. You've touched on this a little bit on the dignity of a job, but I am continually frustrated by both the left and the right that we don't seem to have very many people that can explain that with regard to the minimum wage.
Uh-huh.
And the number of people that every time we raise the minimum wage that we are just confining to never having a job. And I've not found real good data sources to back it up. I know it from my own personal experience. And it's always been kind of a no-brainer. It's been written about from Thomas Sowell. I mean, you can't shake a stick at the number of people that have written about this again and again. But in modern-day times, you know, we now have some of the conservatives on the right talking about we need to raise the minimum wage. We have Walmart, I think, that we should be holding up as an icon of American business, but we constantly seem to want to trash in the press because they give jobs and pay people a decent wage, but apparently it's not enough. And talking about the real data on the other side and how you might approach that along these same lines of finding the people to advocate for.
Thank you. That's one of the things that I do touch on as a case study in the conservative heart is how to talk about the minimum wage, because it's such a tough thing to do. And you hear Republicans talk about it. In early draft of the book, I gave verbatim a debate on the Senate floor between a Republican and a Democrat. And the Democrat got up there and basically spouted a bunch of demagogic nonsense. It's time to give America a raise. But he sounded like he cared about poor people. And the Republican gets up there and he says, this will create an untenable burden on small business, and just it was horrible. He sounded like the most materialistic thing, and it sounded like he was nothing more than a shill for business, and the other guy cared about the poor. That's the way to lose. Now, remember, why do we care about the minimum wage? And the answer is because even according to the CBO estimates, if we go to $10.10 an hour, which is Obama's target minimum wage for the next 2 years, we're going to destroy at least 500,000 jobs. Now, which jobs? Not my teenage kids' jobs. No, my teenage kids are not going to get laid off. It's going to be the people who have the most tenuous grasp on the workforce, who are the most vulnerable population, the people who we do see on the film at night from Ferguson, Missouri, the people who need our help the most and who need the dignity and the organizing principles of earned success through honest work the most in our society. It's a matter of social justice. We cannot afford to destroy their jobs. You get two beers into a liberal, and he will tell you, if their job is destroyed, we can soak them up in the safety net. That is not the right solution, because that does not treat anybody with dignity. Right-wingers who don't recognize that, that somehow think that poor people just want their free stuff, are living in an alternative universe. They're just not getting out and talking to poor people. You don't meet poor people who prefer to get a welfare check as opposed to a paycheck. Everybody wants the dignity of work. I mean, I know there's some who don't, but you get my point. So how do we argue against it? Number one, and this is the most important point, is we fight for the people who will, the poor people who will be hurt by this. Now, it's very easy to be a liberal, because you can just say, time to give America a raise. We have to do something that's more complicated. It's effectively a three-step approach. Number one, state your moral position. Number two, state your objective, your objection to the policy. Step three, offer a better policy. You can't substitute something with nothing. So how do you do it? Number one, moral principle. Look, I believe in America. Rich country. If you work hard, play by the rules, you deserve to be able to support yourself and your family. Not to get rich, but to support yourself. Principle number two, the problem with the minimum wage, it doesn't guarantee that. It's a messy policy. It gives raises to some, but it destroys jobs for others. 82% of the people in the minimum wage are not poor. And the people who are most affected are poor when they lose their jobs. So number three, I got a better policy. What's the better policy? The book has got a lot of the policies in it, but I'll give you one. Let's expand the earned income tax credit. Does it cost money? Yeah. Does the government have to pay for it? Yeah. But that's what I want my taxes to go to, is making work pay without destroying jobs. We expand the earned income tax credit, which is a very successful set of policies. We expanded to especially single men who have non-custodial care of their kids, and we're going to be able to top up their wages to $10.10 an hour if we want to, and not one job will be destroyed. So I got an approach that says, yeah, let's band together in solidarity for the people who need us the most so they can support themselves through honest, dignified work. Two, the minimum wage is a killer for that. So number three, I got a better policy. Come with me. And if our candidates could do that, it would be a different kind of argument than what we're typically hearing.
All right. Well, we had a huge influx of questions. We actually now have 5 more questions and about 20 minutes left. So we'll go right to them.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this call today. I've really enjoyed your statements. I'm especially intrigued by your statement that we should fight for people and not against ideas. Having been a long time DC resident who works in the policy space, the idea that that I'm going to have to get down in and talk about people instead of just ideas is challenging. So can you give some more tips? I think your last answer may have had some of those, but when I'm writing speeches for my boss, how do I avoid being too abstract, and how do I connect with the people out there who need them? I work for the Federal Trade Commission for one of the commissioners here, and I'm trying to when I'm trying to tell her story, her regulatory philosophy, I want to make that connect to people. Do you have any like good tips on how to do that?
For sure, absolutely, and it really starts off with being able to tell stories. In the book that we're talking about here today, I did a lot of field work where I went out. I went to a homeless shelter in New York where I had done a lot of research, and this homeless shelter specializes in the people that we think are least sympathetic in society, the people who are most unlovable. These are men who are single, mostly drug addicted, who have been in prison for 10 to 20 years and are now homeless. I mean, talk about the people that we throw away in society, the true liabilities of society, and say, I want to see somebody who can see where everybody else sees liabilities, where we see assets in those people. And I went and talked to them and got their stories, and I tell their stories. And so I get up and I give a talk. I mean, there's a talk that I give right now called Assets, Not Liabilities, where the full-on conservative message in America today has to be one where we see every single person in our society is an asset to be developed. Nobody's a liability to manage. Left-wing thinking is liabilities to manage when we see the weak. Right-wing thinking should be all about assets to develop. But you can't get that point across. It sounds wonkish and technical until you just tell the story of this guy I met who had been 22 years in prison for murder. And he got out, he spent a year in this program cleaning the streets, learning how to shake hands and look people in the eye. And then he got a low-wage, menial job exterminating bugs, an exterminator. And, you know, Vice President Biden would call that a dead-end job that he should be able to quit. I asked him if he's happy, and he showed me an email from his boss that said, emergency bed bug job, East 65th Street, I need you now. And I said, so? He said, look at this again. It says, I need you now. Nobody has ever said that to me in my whole life. Now, his name is Richard. I want to fight for Richard. I want to see Richard as an asset. I want our whole society to see Richard as an asset. And I want every conservative in America to understand that Richard's an asset. The only way that I can get that across is with Richard's face. So this is the point. If you want to get the point, the human point across of fighting for people instead of against things, don't talk about the things. Always talk about the people and give an example of the person you're touching. If you're writing about, if we're railing against Obamacare, don't fight against Obamacare. Fight for the people who are hurt by Obamacare, the people 10 years from now who are poor and they've never heard of the Obamacare legislation, but they're taught in a tangled mess of bureaucratic waste, and they can't choose their doctors, and they're waiting in a long queue for substandard medicine. That's what we're going to see. Think of the face of those people. Don't fight against teachers' unions if you're into education reform. Fight for children who are poor, who can't choose their schools, and who are getting a substandard education that has zero innovation. And tell me the story of some of their lives. And that's how you do it. It's see the faces and tell the stories.
All right. We still have four questions on the line, so we'll try to get as many of those done as we can. Go right to them. Hi, caller, you're on the line. All right, they must have muted themselves. We'll go, we'll skip them and let them call back.
Hi, I'd like to ask about the unpersuadables. Are the people, I live in New York, most of my friends are liberal Democrats. They watch NBC News at night. They watch PBS at night. They watch MSNBC. They read the New York Times and the comedy watch the Comedy Channel. Are they in the category of unpersuadables, or is there something about the addiction to the mainstream media that those of us with a different outlook can do anything about?
Thank you for that, and you know, God bless you. We need our guys in Manhattan, so I'm glad you're there. I've lived there too, and I've been in the liberal world my whole life. I mean, I grew up in Seattle in a liberal family, which is redundant because there are about 8 Republicans in all of Seattle. So you can expect that this is how I grew up as well. I would classify these people as hostiles largely. When you find people who are over about the age of 35, who have relatively entrenched views, they're consuming media not because it's the only media in town, because it's the media that confirms their bias. Why do we want to burrow into the hostiles? Well, number one is because we want to show that there's a different way of thinking about conservatives. And number two, because there are people who watch our exchanges with them who are persuadables in virtually every environment. I'll give you an example. I have a monthly column that I write. It's in the New York Times. Now, why do I put it in the New York Times? Well, one is because it's a great paper. But two, it's because that's the group, that's the audience I want to be talking to. I mean, I'm not pretending as if the hostile commenters who accuse me of, I could literally write a column called I Like Puppies, and all of the comment section would say, sir, your work belies all of your motives and thoughts, and it would denounce me roundly for my neoconservatism and on and on and on. I mean, it feels like an exercise in futility, but it isn't, because I can't tell you the number of people who've reached out to me and said, I've never heard of the work of the American Enterprise Institute. I've never heard of this kind of thinking, and I'm really interested in it. We've had donors that have come our way. We've had students who've subscribed to our materials, and it's because of you're going into, I mean, think of it as being a missionary on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. You're going to people who are really hostile, and you're answering their anger with brotherly love, and somebody's going to witness this, and that's the first time they're ever going to have seen a really nice conservative, and that's how you win converts. So stay at it, and I'll pray for you.
All right, we'll go to our next question.
Hello. Can you talk about countering the narrative of the war on women?
Thank you very much. This is one of the most virulent narratives that we have that comes out of the left. And the biggest problem is that, once again, we keep reinforcing it with our leaders. We just saw it again this week. I mean, Donald Trump, he set us back by months, years, by the things that he's doing. You know, look, the base of Donald Trump's support is largely, I've looked at the data on this, the bedrock of Donald Trump's support is relatively young men who typically are not involved in politics. And they look at Donald Trump and they say, this is somebody he's not PC, he's going to stick it to the man. And then when he says these things about women, it confirms the biases of all of the people who are sitting on the sidelines, who are maybe persuadable who are watching what we've got going on. So what do we have to do? We have to counter it by being aggressive in how we talk about gender issues and issues that are important to women. Now, by the way, this does not mean that conservatives suddenly have to start embracing a pro-choice issue. It is a myth, based on the data, that women care most about abortion rights. What women don't like are men who are hostile and simply calloused in the way they're talking about women's rights and women's decisions. So you can, as long as you are very respectful, you're clearly not misogynistic, and you're paying attention to a lot of the things that women care the most about, for example, education, security of the family, basic family issues in general, and economic advancement and opportunity, that you can do perfectly well with women. And we've seen it in the past with all kinds of politicians. But again, this starts with proper discipline among people on our side. And the last week has done us a lot of damage.
All right, well, we are finishing up with Dr. Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute on his book, The Conservative Heart, and we have two more questions pending, and we should be able to get through both of those.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. This is Roger Severino from the DeVos Center at the Heritage Foundation. I have a question on how your framework works in the context of big business. So on social issues, we've seen that big business has cut funding to organizations like the Boy Scouts of America because of their policy on gay scout leaders. And Brendan Eich was forced out of Mozilla when it was discovered that he had donated to Prop 8, even though he had never discriminated against anybody in his life, as far as anyone could tell. And on the other side, we see big business not cutting ties to Planned Parenthood, even after the scandal of the videos regarding the alleged selling of baby body parts. So I can't imagine any more humanizing issues than those two. You got Boy Scouts and children, people getting fired, and Planned Parenthood. Yet we're not seeing, at least I haven't seen, your theories working in the other direction on those issues. And if you could comment on that.
Sure. I'm not sure I'm ready to concede the case on Planned Parenthood. One of the things that we've seen is that the companies that were proud sponsors of Planned Parenthood have almost uniformly demanded that their names be taken off the Planned Parenthood site. That's the beginning of advance on this particular campaign that we should have of trying to effectively shame for companies that are involved in illicit activities. Now, it is true that the left started doing this a long time before we did, when they started trying to create stigma around being involved in the Boy Scouts of America, but it took them a long time to do it. It took them 15 years of organizing this activity, and the right has only started doing it very, very recently. It's been 10 years now that we've had activist organizations that are threatening boycotts of companies that advertise on Rush Limbaugh's show, and it's hurting the EIB network, and it's hurting the stations a lot. Even though Rush Limbaugh has 14 million listeners a week, they're having a hard time getting the advertising because of this activism that's been going on for a really long time. I think that if we actually do some of the same thing, given the fact that clearly a big, much bigger majority finds noxious the activities of Planned Parenthood as opposed to the Boy Scouts of America, if you went to anybody and said, I'm going to go work for the Boy Scouts, there's nothing controversial about that except in really elite left-wing circles. And if you went to these days, nobody's going to want to say, except in elite left-wing circles, I want to go work for Planned Parenthood. We should be ahead of the game, but we have to start in the same set of tactics of trying to use stigma in the same way that they do, and it takes some time. So I'm not ready to concede the ground yet. I think that we can actually be even more effective than the left, but we have to take a page out of their book and learn from what they've done.
All right, looks like we have one final question for Arthur Brooks. Here we go.
Hello, and thanks again for writing this book and doing this session. I have a rather, I think, simplistic question, which perhaps relates to your last answer and relates to the book you wrote, The Battle, I guess 2 books ago, which is just a question I've been wrestling with. You talk about the 30% coalition and their views, which you've talked about today in the media, and then the 70% that have this more conservative agenda. well, if it's 70%, why aren't these people either voting, or are we not intelligent enough to speak out? Are we meek? Why is, if there's 70% that are more aligned with this perspective, not more influence? Because, again, they vote and they read things. So there seems to be a disparity there, which I'd love for you to explain, and I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to ask.
Thank you. And I appreciate the question. It's not simplistic at all. It's a really important question. The data have remained relatively constant that about 70% of Americans agree with the fundamental worldview, the fundamental center-right worldview. They're not hateful. They're not necessarily even activists, but they're basically center-right. They believe in mainstream family values. They believe in hard work. I mean, look, even Democrats, you ask, should welfare be accompanied by work? And 92% of registered Democrats say yes. So the value of faith and family and non-fragmented communities and hard work. I mean, this stuff is baseball and apple pie to Americans. This is in 70%, and it's 70% at least. I mean, that's the lower bound. Yet these things seem to be in retreat so much. How can this be? Well, part of it is because the left for the longest time has been in the business of fighting for people who are actually calling themselves liberals. Depending on what poll you look at, it's about 20% of the population. Literally, they call themselves the 99%. That's been the technique of the left from the very beginning, to inflate their numbers by fighting for people and advocating for large groups, as opposed to the right, which has doubled down again and again and again about fighting against things. Now, setting itself up effectively, the Republicans, as the angry party, has meant that this sort of mushy middle of Americans who don't consider themselves to be political conservatives but have center-right sentiments have been driven away from what we're doing by the war on women, by the idea that we hate homosexuals, by this idea that we're anti-poor and all these people being left behind will be hurt by conservative ideas. These are the people, the other part, the silent part of the 70% who voted for Obama fair and square with his campaign in 2008 of unity and optimism. And now they look at it and they see competing pessimisms. They don't like it. They're up for grabs. We can get them back, but the only way is to give them an excuse. And the only excuse they're going to take is optimism and unity and inclusiveness and aspiration. The only one that they're going to take. And that's what we have to do to get them back. So far, the short answer to your question is we've not given them an excuse, and we've frittered away 30% of the American voting population.
Well, it looks like we're heading right to the end of the hour. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Dr. Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, for joining us today to talk about his new book, The Conservative Heart, How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. As a reminder, it's available on Amazon.com and at bookstores. And the link to the book is also on our website and on the notification email for this call. So, and a reminder to any of you, if you missed the first part of the call or want to re-listen to it, we'll be posting this Teleform call as a podcast on our website at fedsoc.org in the next couple days. You can always go back and check out this podcast as well as all of our previous Teleform conference calls. A reminder that our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Monday, August 17th on an update on the net neutrality litigation. So until then, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much, and thank you to Dr. Brooks.
Thank you to all of you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.